Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Connie reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Thursday, May 28, 2020. Ty Anders arrest aftermath. City to hold community conversation by Caitlin Randall. A community conversation. When? 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. today. Where? Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center, 2300 Butternut Lane. Overflow rooms will be available in addition to the auditorium. Social distancing will be in place. Masks, gloves, and hand sanitizer will be available. The City of Midland will hold the first of several planned community conversations this evening to address the May 16th incident between Ty Anders and Midland Police. The events also will be a chance to discuss relations between law enforcement and minority members of the community. John Norman, councilman for District 2, said while he expects residents to ask questions about the scene that went viral on social media, 21-year-old Anders lying in the grass, Midland Police Department officers pointing guns at him, he hopes the meeting will be a platform for open dialogue. I believe the incident is just opening the door for us to have that community conversation, he said in an interview, because it's nothing new to a lot of people. It's been going on for years across the country. Norman said he is avoiding describing the event as a town hall because he believes the phrase has a negative connotation of leaders hosting discussions and then nothing changes. He said the conversations are meant to be led to new ideas for bridging the gap between police and residents of District 2, a predominantly minority district. There's a real truth to the concerns and frustrations of residents of District 2. And I believe in order to do something about it, we first have to sit down and listen to those concerns and frustrations, and then implement a plan of action to move forward, he said. That plan of action could include a community liaison, someone with a law enforcement background to serve as a voice for African Americans and other minorities, Norman said, and a greater emphasis on recruiting minorities to work in the police department. He also sees potential for an additional diversity training and possibly more education for community members on interacting with police during traffic stops and other exchanges. The confrontation between Anders and at least five officers was the second in a one-month span in which the MPD was accused of racial profiling and excessive aggressiveness. Video captured and shared by a bystander in late April shows a 16-year-old Fernando Rodriguez being kicked to the ground by an officer. A city spokesperson later said the officer used an approved front push kick after Rodriguez, who is Hispanic, failed to kneel fully as officers had directed him to for handcuffing. We have to have these tough conversations in order to move forward, Norman said. We have to have an understanding from both sides because everyone doesn't look at everything in the same lens. We have to understand there are different lenses out there that we may not be aware of. Midland County Commissioner Louis Sanchez said he would be attending the event and was looking forward to hearing the discussions. His precinct, Precinct 3, includes the portion of city of Midland District 2 where the incident on May 16th occurred. The meeting will be held at the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center beginning at 6 p.m. Norman said it will be divided into a question and answer session, when a panel will answer questions that residents write on note cards and are read by a moderator, followed by a life experiences section, which will give residents the opportunity to speak about their personal experiences. The panel will include Mayor Patrick Payton and Police Chief Seth Herman. I believe people are willing to talk, and I believe people are willing to listen, Norman said. I believe people are willing to do the right thing and make things better as a whole for the entire city. Education. MISD meeting to focus on next bond proposal by Stuart Doran. Midland ISD leaders will host meetings next week about a future bond proposal. The district sent out emails to those who acknowledged the need for a bond but opposed that particular bond in November. Those individuals, according to the district, are Jennifer Carpenter, Sherry Caldwell, Matt Galindo, Sarah Gonzalez, Sarah Hale, Melinda Hall, Brandon Hodges, Esme Juarez, Heidi Kirk, Jenny Langford, Kenny K. Murchison, John Parchman, Courtney Ratliff, Rachel Stone, Kristen Vasquez, Mike White, Christian Yandon, Craig Yenzer, and Kimberly Crisp. Following the bond's narrow defeat, we had communications with several persons of that view about getting together to discuss what they would be willing to support in a future bond proposal, Midland ISD stated in an email sent out to selected people in the community. We would like to follow up on those discussions and invite you to attend an informal meeting to do just that. The following meetings are set: Tuesday at DeSalva Elementary, Wednesday at Yarborough Elementary, June 8th at Santa Rita Elementary, June 9th at Bush Elementary School, and June 11th at Great House Elementary School. The purpose of this meeting is for us to listen to what you would like to see in any future bond proposal, the process by which any such future proposal should be formulated, and how the community should be educated about its component parts, Midland ISD wrote in the email. To facilitate an opportunity for you to express your views and to comply with CDC COVID-19 social gathering and social distancing guidelines, the meeting will consist of two or three other citizens, your district trustee representative, one or two other MISD trustees, and 2 or 3 MISD administrative staff. The letter stated that residents invited will be asked their views on the following questions. What would you like to see included again as part of any future bond proposal? What would you not like to see included again as part of any future bond proposal? What would you like to see included as part of any future bond proposal that was not included in the last proposal? What thoughts do you have on how the process in formulating a future bond proposal should work? What thoughts do you have on how the community should be educated and informed about the components of any future bond proposal? Matt Galindo, who resides in District 1 and has been vocal about change he'd like to see take place in the district, said he appreciated the opportunity to sit down with MISD leaders and other community members. When called by the Reporter Telegram about the letter and the meetings, Galindo said, "Now is not the time to talk about a new bond." He said that it would be more appropriate for the community to talk about a new bond after the November elections, when voters decide on 4 board seats, districts 1, 2, 4, and 7, and that those elections will set the tone for the district moving forward. To rush into a bond is not the right idea, Galindo said. I hope they are not trying to get one on November's ballot. I thought the last bond happened too fast. The first I found out about it was a flyer in my daughter's backpack. Board President Rick Davis recently told the Reporter Telegram in an email he thought a bond wouldn't take place in November and that 2021 was more likely. Midland ISD offered the following statement from Davis about the meetings. Following the narrow defeat of the November 2019 MISD bond proposal, Midland trustees engaged in conversations with a number of persons across the community who acknowledged the need for a bond to address our district's academic, capacity, technology, and safety and security needs, but expressed opposition to that particular bond proposal about getting together to listen to what they would be willing to support in a future bond proposal. Unfortunately, the coronavirus pandemic intervened, and one of its many consequences is that it delayed the scheduling of these informal listening sessions. We will now move forward with them while observing all CDC COVID-19 social gathering and social distancing guidelines. These initial listening sessions are only the first step in what will be a lengthy, multi-step process over the next 12 or more months to gather information and seek community input on any future bond proposal. The process by which any such future proposal should be formulated and how best to inform the community about its component parts. Commentary. Coronavirus blows $400 billion hole in global energy. By Lyman Denning, Bloomberg. COVID-19 has blown a $400 billion hole in global energy. How we fix it will determine our success or failure versus that other implacable force of nature, climate change. The International Energy Agency's latest investment review, released Wednesday, could easily be subtitled, "Don't Let a Good Crisis Go to Waste." That figure of $400 billion or so is the difference between where the IEA's projection for energy investment in 2020 began the year, 2% growth, and where it now thinks it will land, a 20% decline. To put that figure in perspective, it's not far short of all the money that went in to the oil and gas production business last year, which is apt since that's been hit hardest. One of COVID-19's secondary victims is mobility, so oil consumption has plunged. Even so, IEA head Fatih Birol poured cold water on the notion that peak oil demand may have happened already. Speaking with Bloomberg News ahead of the report's release, he said, "In the absence of strong government policies, a sustained economic recovery, and low oil prices are likely to take global oil demand back to where it was and beyond." It's fairly easy to take issue with this prediction. We are barely months into possibly the most consequential economic dislocation the world has seen in many decades, and possibly only months away from another round of it. On the other hand, I don't read Burl's statement as a prediction, more of a warning. The key phrase there concerns strong government policies. COVID-19 raises the issue of agency with devastating clarity, facing with an alarming risk. What do we choose to do? Oil demand may suffer long-lasting scars from changes in behavior or sheer economic trauma, but it is rising again off the bottom. The IEA raises the specter of 9 million barrels a day of day of missing supply in 2025 if investment doesn't increase from here, perhaps touching off another round of high prices for a global economy that may be just getting over the pandemic. This looks extreme. Price signals wouldn't stay dormant for that long. Yet it ought to serve its rhetorical purpose, producing us to consider collectively why we wouldn't try to do things differently. For all the damage inflicted on fossil fuel producers, incumbency remains a potential force, quite apart from the petrostates whose existence rests to a large degree on oil's indefinite prosperity. Consider the downstream parts of the business. Last year saw a record amount of new liquefied natural gas capacity approved. Meanwhile, 2.2 million barrels a day of refining capacity was switched on last year, more than double the increase in demand, and another 6 million is due by 2025. Too much even in an alternate non-COVID-19 reality. Steel in the ground tends to create realities of its own. Like the oil supply currently and reluctantly being held off the market today, The underutilized plants of tomorrow will seek any opportunity to push cheap molecules into the market whenever they can. There is no good reason why, when that $400 billion or so of investment comes back, it must be spent according to old patterns, embedding chronic conditions of boom and bust, geopolitical tremors, and of course, runaway climate change. A striking find in the IEA report is that spending on the electricity services will outpace spending on oil products this year for the first time this century, and quite possibly ever. The fact it's happening in a plague year means that isn't a turning point, but it does emphasize the scale of the power business and the scope for investment. The IEA's long-term scenario under current government mandates is known as stated policies or steps. The more ambitious one, moving the world closer to Paris Agreement goals, albeit with too much reliance on carbon capture after 2050, is called Sustainable Development, or SDS. Scenarios entail spending, and even under the weaker policy environment, the IEA projects investment in renewables to top that of gas supply. Under SDS, it soars past both gas and oil. Taken together, investment in renewables and power networks would average almost $1 trillion a year globally in the back half of the decade, a jump of 69% versus 2019. Oil and gas, meanwhile, rise by just 16% under the more favorable scenario and drop 7% under the climate-friendlier one, with oil dropping 17% within that. $1 trillion a year, especially in the context of changes in policy, will sound like big government run amok to some. But check your priors. Investment in oil and gas supply was already about $750 billion last year, and that was down from mid-decade levels. Renewables and electrification projects also should create more jobs and lend themselves to more rapid deployment. Think move fast and fix things. Meanwhile, despite the prevailing wisdom, governments play a much bigger direct role in fossil fuels than in renewables. The share of government or state-owned enterprises in oil and gas supply or fossil fuel power generations investment is about 40% to 50%, according to the IEA, versus roughly 15% for renewable energy and efficiency projects. What did you actually think? Saudi Aramco is a private company now? Yes, there are renewable portfolio standards and other policies that encourage more solar and wind power. But those exist because collective myopia has allowed incumbent fossil fuel interests to lobby successfully against more transparent pricing of carbon. Yet even with that hindrance, the rapid drop in renewable energy costs means a dollar spent on those technologies last year bought 50% more capacity than it did in 2012. Imagine the gains possible if market signals were aimed squarely at addressing climate change. If we are going to spend trillions powering our post-COVID societies anyway, why not optimize it for good outcomes? Permian Basin's OPERA's new project aims to build Library of Songs for Parents by J.C. Lewis. The Permian Basin Opera has brought opera to people's homes during the pandemic with the Lullaby Project. Artistic director Andrew Nyberg said PBO is working on expanding the project beyond the four previously announced videos. The second episode, featuring baritone Craig Irvin, airs at 7 p.m. today. Those will stockpile into a tool for parents to use that there will be enough of those that parents can use to help their children sleep at night or when kids are having a difficult time, they can play them soothing music, he said. Nyan Baber said the organization is working on some other projects, but the Lullaby Project has become the main focus to help create an online library for children and families. It has been important that the performers are professional singers and that they are singing approachable songs. They are singing songs that are in the modern common repertory, mostly in English, he said. It's a way to get introduced to opera without having to jump into the deep end of a 3-hour-long Italian complex piece of theater with orchestra and everything. The performances are 2.5 minutes on YouTube, and it's probably a song people will recognize. The Lullaby Project has been a positive endeavor which continues to grow, Nyan Baber said. This has been a good way for some of them to perform while live performances have been canceled, he said, especially for a performer who will be coming out in a couple of weeks. It was her first time singing since the pandemic hit. The fifth video will be mezzo-soprano Elise Quagliasta will be singing a traditional lullaby and will be singing with her daughter, Nyan Baber said. He said PBO is working on securing 2 more artists and will continue to seek out other performers for the series. The episodes are pre-recorded. Nyan Baber said the project came about when executive director Sarah Jones saw on YouTube a series of videos of celebrities and authors reading bedtime stories. Jones has 2 small children and thought it would be a good idea to have singers do lullabies. The demands being made for parents' time and energy is extraordinary during this time, he said. That was a big part of our thinking in creating this. What if we could give them, parents, 2 minutes where they can turn on this video and they can be reassured that it is positive, calming, and artistic? They can take a breath. This has been a tough time for the organization, which is going through a transition period. Permian Basin Opera, which has changed its format, had a performance in March with Elixir of Love, Nyan Baber said. They were planning a big fundraising gala for December, but it has been canceled. We have dramatically changed the scope and reach of the company, along with the goal and mission of the company, he said. This was supposed to be the time when we started to build our donor base and create a group of people we can rely on. He said, during difficult times, people tend to search out the arts more. In turn, organizations need help from people during hard economic times. Obituaries. Andy Sweeney. Andy Sweeney of Robert Lee, Texas, passed too soon from this life, Tuesday, May 19, 2020. He survived major surgery, exceeding all goals set by his doctors, but an unexpected heart attack cut short his road to victory. Andy was born in Oklahoma, July 8, 1961, moving to Texas as an infant. He graduated from Colorado City High School in 1979. After graduation, he moved to Midland, Texas, working in the bottled water industry. In 1991, he started his own company, PBAE, and for over 25 years provided supported employment services for disabled individuals. Most recently, he was enjoying success in oil field wireline sales. After losing his beloved mother, Shirley Kilo-Best, in 2011, Andy moved from Midland and realized his dream of living by the lake. He quickly adopted Robert Lee as his hometown and was active in the community. He was a valued board member of the Coke County Water Supply Corporation and ran for county commissioner. His heart was in rural Coke County near Lake Spence, where he lived. He was closest to his God sitting on his deck, watching the sunset and chatting with him. Above all else, he loved his wife, his children, his grandchildren, his Boston Terriers, and the Dallas Cowboys. Andy's legacy includes his wife of 36 years, Kim Knotgrass Sweeney, son Jordan Sweeney, and wife Andrea, daughter Megan Sweeney Cox, and husband John, his squirrels Brooklyn Sweeney, Braylee Sweeney, Briar Sweeney, and Mandy Wheeler, and his chipmunk Briggs Sweeney, his two adored sisters Andrea Hernandez and husband Danny, and Anita McKee and husband Kurt, a brother, much-loved nephews and nieces, a great-nephew and a great-niece. An outdoor memorial service will be held Saturday, May 30th, 2020 at 11 a.m. at the Pavilion overlooking Lake Spence near Robert Lee, Texas. In consideration of the COVID-19 situation, the family requests that social distancing and grouping guidelines be observed. Masks are not required, but please take whatever precautions you feel necessary for your safety. Flowers may be sent to Shafford Funeral Home, Grape Creek, Texas, or in lieu of flowers, donations may be made in his memory to Centers for Children and Families, Midland, Texas. Arrangements are by Shafford Funeral Home, Grape Creek. Anne Lemarquin Newman. Anne Lemarquin Newman, 73, most recently of Abilene, Texas, passed away at her home on Friday, May 22, 2020. She was born Pauline Lemarquin on Saturday, November 9, 1946, in Midland, Texas, to Edward Philip Lemarquin and Wauna Jones Lamarquand. She was known by friends and loved ones as Anne and Nanny to her grandchildren. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, May 29th, 2020, at the Hamill Family Funeral Home, 6449 Buffalo Gap Road, with Pastor Stan Alcorn of Pioneer Drive Baptist Church officiating. Anne grew up in Midland and Snyder, Texas, where she made lifelong friends. She graduated from Midland High School and went on to the University of Texas at Austin. While working in Austin, she met the love of her life, Tom Newman. They married August 5th, 1966 in Austin, Texas. In 1969, they moved to Midland where they raised their family. Anne and Tom were passionate about their family, friends, cooking, and travel. She was preceded in death by her parents, Edward and Wyona Lamarquand, husband Thomas Newman, and daughter Ashley Elise Godovac. Anne is survived by her daughter, Karen Newman Woolscroft, and husband Kent of Abilene, Texas. Their children, Alex from Austin, Texas, Jeffrey and wife Summer in Dallas, Texas, and Anne, son Ted Newman of Austin, Texas, and wife Sherry, their children Wyatt and Ella, granddaughter Victoria Godovac in Lubbock, Texas, grandsons Porter and Gage Godovac in Dallas, Texas, sister Liz Lamarquand and her children Megan, Philip, and Ross Jones, sister Lauren Rich and husband John and their children Jennifer Wetmore and husband Jason, and Casey Wisenut and husband Jonathan, their children Hayden, Kinsley, and Logan. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to rescue the animals, the Abilene Food Pantry, or Meals on Wheels. Memories may be shared and condolences submitted online at www.hamillfamilyfuneralhome.com. Cheryl Lee Lepard. Cheryl Lee Lepard, 81, of Granbury, passed away Monday, May 25th, 2020, at her residence. Graveside services will be 1 p.m. Saturday, May 30th, 2020, at the Mount Olive Memorial Park Chapel. She was born October 2nd, 1938, in Garden City, Kansas, to George and Agnes Grimm. She was the eldest of three sisters. She married Robert Glenn Lepard on January 26, 1957, in Portales, New Mexico. Their love story has lasted 63 years. Cheryl grew up in Midland, Texas, and graduated from Midland High in 1956, and later she graduated from Howard College in 1963. Glenn and Cheryl resided in Big Spring, where all three of their children were born. Her successful career in personnel began at Webb AFB. She transferred to Lowry AFB, Denver, Colorado, in 1976 and retired from Randolph AFB, San Antonio, Texas, in 1993. She was a very loving and caring person, a wonderful mother, grandmother, and friend, and an adored, beautiful wife. She was loved by so many and will be missed. Survivors include her husband, Glenn Lepard of Granbury, a daughter, Diana Vasquez, and Tommy of Dallas, and Jewel Julia Lepard of Huntsville, grandsons Bobby Lee Martin and Melissa, and Mickey Ball, granddaughter Maggie Ball, great-grandchildren Joshua Elmer, Jasmine Martin, and Christina Martin, two sisters Norma Dean and Georgia Ford with Dilbert, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. She was preceded in death by her parents, George and Agnes Grimm, and her son, Robert Glenn Lepard, Jr. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Sistonas Foundation at sistonas.com/donate. Arrangements are made under the direction of Natalie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.mpwelch.com. Kenneth E. Griffin. On May 17, 2020, Kenneth E. Griffin, a dedicated Christian, loving husband, and father of four, passed away at the age of 83. Anyone who had the fortune of knowing him will remember his family demeanor, tireless work ethic, and uncanny ability to make you laugh. He was born on November 2, 1936, in Littlefield, Texas, to J.M. and Thelma Griffin. On October 18, 1958, he married his high school sweetheart, Betty Lou Purdy. Together they raised four children, Kelly, Kurt, Kevin, and Kyle. In 1967, Ken moved his family to Midland, Texas, where he worked in the oil and gas industry as a piping estimator, piping designer, and draftsman. After a long and successful career, Ken retired in 2016. His devotion to his faith played a significant role in his life inside and out of the church. Baptized in 1958 at Crescent Park Church of Christ in Littlefield, Texas, Ken remained active in the church by serving as deacon at Fairmont Park Church of Christ in Midland and teaching, mentoring, and encouraging youth of the congregation. Bringing his light to his community, he coached youth teams at the YMCA and Little League of Midland sports programs, and also volunteered his time to the Midland County Sheriff Reserves. Kenneth was preceded in death by his father, J.M., and his mother, Thelma. He is survived by his wife, Betty Lou, his brother, Melvin, his sister, Melba, his four children, Kelly, Kevin, Kurt, and Kyle, four grandchildren, and four great-grandchildren. While flowers are appreciated, the family requests that other contributions be made to the Wounded Warrior Project at www.woundedwarriorproject.org. Death notices. Andrea Rodriguez Hernandez, 23, of Midland, passed away Friday, May 22, 2020. Visitation will be held Thursday, May 28, 2020, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. with her Holy Rosary to be recited that evening at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. Funeral procession will be leaving Heavenly Gate at 9:30 a.m. on Friday, May 29, 2020, to Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church to celebrate her funeral mass at 10 a.m. with Father David Herrera officiating. Burial will follow at Serenity Cemetery. She is survived by her husband, Louis Monhe, and her kids, Louis Jr., Delizia, and Alicia. Her mother, Jessica Juarez, stepfather, Juan Daniel Juarez, father, Andres Hernandez, stepmother, Tiffany Hernandez, maternal great-grandmother, Lydia Jimenez, grandparents, Luz and Felix Rodriguez Sr., paternal grandmother, Alicia Banda, and two brothers and five sisters. Ivy Lee Green. Ivy Lee Green, 68, of Midland, passed away on May 27th, 2020, in Midland, Texas. Ivy was born on April 21, 1952, to Dorothy McGruder and Beau Alexander in Dawson County, Texas. There are no services scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory.
Hello. This is Kay, reading the Odessa American for Thursday, May 28, 2020, front page. Community Welcomes New PHS Principal by Ruth Campbell, RCAMPBELL at OAOA.com. Delisa Stiles is happy to be getting back to her favorite educational role, high school principal, when she takes the helm of Permian High School starting July 1st. The Ector County ISD Board of Trustees approved hiring Stiles at its May 19th meeting. She was introduced to the community Wednesday during a meet and greet at the PHS library. 10 people at a time were let in, and everyone wore masks. There was also hand sanitizer and distance markers, a sign of the COVID-19 times. The occasion attracted people from ECISD, University of Texas Permian Basin, and Odessa College. According to information obtained through an open records request, Stiles' proposed base salary is $131,206. Her travel allowance is $4,325 a year. Her doctorate stipend is $3,650 a year, and her relocation allowance is $3,000. She earned a Bachelor of Science degree in elementary education from Texas Tech University, a Master's degree in Educational Administration from Midwestern State University, and a doctoral degree in Educational Administration from the University of North Texas. Stiles holds certifications in superintendent, mid-management, special education, English as a second language, ESL, physical education, and has a kindergarten endorsement. Most recently, she served as assistant superintendent for curriculum and instruction at Fredericksburg ISD, according to that district's website. Stiles said Wednesday she is approaching 30 years in education. "I'm just so excited to be back in the role of principal. I was a high school principal in Graham. It was by far my favorite job, but based on the ages of my kids and an elementary position opened up in Fredericksburg, my husband and I relocated there. We've been there 11 years. But I also pride myself on the 13 years of teaching in the classroom because I'm thinking you need to have just a good, solid foundation of what instruction can look like," Stiles said. She added that it's important to be able to help coach teachers, build capacity in the classroom, and empower teachers. Stiles' husband, Jeff, is a technology specialist at Fredericksburg. "They have been married almost 35 years and have four children, ranging from 32 down to 10. I thrive off the daily energy that you have at a campus level, especially a high school level, where you can pour into the kids one last time before they leave for college. That was my favorite job, honestly, in administration, was being a high school principal. So to have an opportunity to come back and be able to interact daily with teachers and kids, it's fast-paced. There's a lot of uncertainty sometimes that can unfold at a high school, but that's the part of it that energizes me. I love the excitement and just being able to tap into kids' potentials and also just to be able to be in their corner and form relationships and help them see their potential. Nowhere is that more available than at a high school, Stiles said. From the time she was about 10, she became the babysitter in her neighborhood and developed a love of taking care of children. She also loved school herself and admired her teachers. I really felt like for me early on, it was a calling. Initially, Stiles' goals for Permian are to listen, learn, look, respect the culture, and honor the traditions. Where changes need to be made, especially in light of COVID-19, she said they will continue to provide learning opportunities for students and will solicit staff feedback where revisions are needed. Just working with the team and getting input from parents and students, and again, respecting the rich traditions here, helping us move forward academically, athletically, everything with the fine arts programs here that are already strong, the dual credit. There's just so many angles that we can help just take to the next level, Stiles said. At the same meeting Stiles was hired, Deborah Otmers also was approved by the board as chief financial officer. They were both from Fredericksburg ISD. She said they were unaware that they were going for jobs at ECISD. She's a wonderful co-worker. She's actually someone that I work with at Central Office, but we can take an oath that neither one of us knew, Stiles said. She said she also didn't know Superintendent Scott Murray, but has heard wonderful things about him. I'm excited to be working with them in district administration, as well as the entire faculty here, Stiles said. Fredericksburg ISD has around 3,000 students, and PHS has close to 4,000 students. Stiles said she has not worked at a school the size of Permian, but she said her 29 years of experience of building relationships and trust should help. You have to have all the foundational blocks before we really can move forward with any progress. So my goal is to keep the communication at the level it is, or enhance it if it needs to be improved, and just jump in there, roll up my sleeves, and get to work, Stiles said. Asked what she thought of the Permian Basin, she said she and her husband noticed the hospitality is second to none. Just being out in the community and working with realtors and at the restaurants, there's so much love for Permian High School, as well as Odessa High. You guys are proud of your schools, Stiles said. Executive Director of Secondary Education Robert Cedillo said in an email that Stiles has the ability and skill to set and create strong lines of communication with and among teachers, students, and parents. She has proven to be able to accept input, involve staff with important decisions, and plan in order to execute effectively. Her experience and involvement in the design and implementation of curriculum, instruction, and assessment practices will definitely support student learning, Cedillo said. County Tax Money Falling by Bob Campbell. B-C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L at OAOA.com. The COVID-19 pandemic is clobbering Ector County sales tax receipts, but conservative budgeting last year will cover all the county's expenses for this fiscal year. The real pain will surface next year when the full effects of the pandemic and the concomitant decrease in customers' traffic will be felt, commissioners say. Approved by the voters in November 2018, the first receipts from the 1.25-cent levy arrived in April last year, before $11,775,934 came in during the fiscal year ending September 30th. Receipts so far this year have totaled $11,775,934 for a total since the tax started being collected of $23,254,318. The Texas Comptroller's Office pays the county each month from the receipts of 2 months earlier. For example, $1,838,515 it got this month was from business in March, when the pandemic first came to the fore around mid-month. Now that April's business will be reflected in June, the next results will no doubt be unfavorable, Precinct 2 Commissioner Eddie Shelton said. This April's tax revenues were $1,694,233. From February and in March, they were $1,885,134 from January. It has been at least $1.7 million every month, the commissioner said. It's my understanding that the money will continue to go down as a direct result of all the sales decreasing and the oil price dropping. Initial expectations were that the tax would bring in $18 million annually, and Shelton said the commissioners conservatively budgeting for $14,660,263 in revenues this fiscal year means that another $3,187,880 will be needed by the end of the budget for everything to be covered. But with the 2020-21 budgeting process starting August 3rd, the hard part will be estimating just how much less money there will be. Ad valorem or property taxes and hotel-motel receipts from the County Coliseum will also probably be down, Shelton said. This won't affect our road projects that are under contract or have been budgeted, he said. They've been funded. The ad valorem taxes will follow suit, but not quite as fast. Precinct 3 Commissioner Dale Childers said some retailers like Sam's Club and HEB have continued to prosper, but there aren't many such stores outside the Odessa city limits. Our sales are mostly of oil field equipment, so obviously those are down, Childers said. We have very few supermarkets or retail stores like those for the general public. I'm really glad we were conservative with the revenues budget. The tough part will be next year. He said economic conditions will get really trying if COVID-19 comes back with the next flu season in December and January. It will be tragic for our budget in 2021 if we go through another one of these, Childers said. I hope that doesn't happen, but who knows?
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.